So good evening, everyone. So I'm sorry I missed the class last week, and I trust you're in good hands with Brigitte. So this is the third day in a five-part introductory course of mindfulness, and people are still coming in a little bit, and I thought it might be nice just take the first few minutes to see if at this point, kind of halfway through, if anyone had any questions or about the practice or what's been said so far, or about their own experiences in trying the meditation at home. Yes?
It's difficult with young children around. I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old. And the only way that I have been able to do it is to make them their own little meditation corner in their room.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So I go to mine and you go to yours.
And they sit there very quietly for half an hour, 45 minutes. Oh.
So I don't quite know what to do with that yet.
Yeah, it's a big, big challenge, and a lot of parents are challenged that way. And I've heard wonderful stories of, especially when the kids are a little bit younger, where they come in, for at least for a little while, they come and actually sit on the parents' lap and meditate with them, or just cuddle up. I tend to meditate though before or after my child's gone to sleep, you know, in the morning or in the evening, because it's hopeless when our baby during. So it's, you know, it's figuring out how to do it is definitely a challenge. But one of the nice things, interesting things about mindfulness is that a mindfulness practice doesn't only entail a practice on the meditation cushion in meditation. It's also a mindfulness practice of what's going on in our daily life. And certainly parenting is a wonderful place to develop mindfulness and attention. Any questions, concerns about the practice? Any reports? Has it been, those of you who've been trying it, has it been easy or difficult? Easy or difficult to get to doing it? Yes?
I have a question that's maybe too big for you to answer. I've been coming every once in a while to this meditation. Occasionally I'll have a friend say, well, I've been doing Zen meditation at the Zen Center. And I'll say, well, I've been doing Vipassana meditation. And I'll say, what's the difference? I don't know. To me, there is no difference.
It depends on the, you know, I've done both. I'm actually a teacher in both traditions. So, you know, you'd think I have a lot to say about it. The meditation practices themselves are very similar in the Soto Zen tradition, which is the Zen center of Mountain View, and what we do. They're quite similar. Sometimes the initial instructions is different for kind of beginners. The tendency there is they teach beginners to count their breath, and we teach what I'm teaching here. Once a person has kind of matured in the practice is basically the same, the meditation practice. It kind of comes to the same thing. What's different is some of the context that the two traditions place that particular meditation practice. And so there's a different context, and that's all, that goes from a doctrinal context to a cultural context, to a social context. One of the differences, it's not inherent, but one of the differences is that Zen in America was brought to America primarily by monastics, by priests. And so they brought with them a little bit of monastic flavor, or quite a bit of monastic flavor. Whereas this particular practice was brought by Westerners who studied in Asia and came here and disrobed, were maybe monks in Asia or nuns in Asia, disrobed and were teaching as lay people. And so they didn't bring with them a lot of the monastic context and forms. So it tends to be much more informal, this the context for this practice. If you go to the Mountain View Zen Center, it feels much more formal because of the monastic background that continues. So there's contextual differences, And how important those are is a matter of opinion. So that's, you know, I could go on and on. Since, you know, I do both. Yes?
So now that you're brought up, I just found myself doing that, I guess, from things I've heard.
Uh-huh.
When I really couldn't seem to stay in with my breath.
Uh-huh.
And I just kind of go 1, 2, and then 1, 2. I'm not counting on and on.
Uh-huh.
What do you think of that as a way to sort of get started?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's
fine.
Yeah, it's a fine way of getting started. It's a counting the breath is more of a concentration practice than a mindfulness practice. And concentration practices are useful when the monkey mind is just too much, you know, a monkey, and it's just like, you know, it just not only is it wild and all over the place, and you can't get yourself present, but the more you try, the more you agitate yourself, and the more kind of scattered you get. Then having something very simple to do. Like counting the breath, it's kind of steady, stable, focused. It can create focus and let the mind begin to quiet down and get stable. And once the mind has some stability, some calmness, then to let go of the counting and open more to the mindfulness practice. So in our tradition, we usually don't publicly instruct people to count the breath. But if a student comes and talks to a teacher one-on-one about their particular experience, sometimes a teacher will say, it would be a good idea if you counted the breath. And this ties to another issue which I thought maybe mentioning today, and that is in the Buddhist tradition, they tend to divide up meditation practices into two general categories of meditation. One category is concentration practices, and Buddhism has a whole repertoire of different kinds of concentration exercises a person can do. They are, for example, counting the breath. They are, for example, using a mantra, using a visualization, using an image that the mind forms. And the function of concentration practice is to let the mind become absorbed on one thing, so it kind of forgets its environment, forgets everything, but just at one thing. You know, if you're at work or doing some project or watching some, you know, fantastically interesting television program or reading a great, great book, you know, and someone calls out your name, you don't even hear them because you're just really, you know, absorbed in that book, kind of fixed in a kind of concentrated way. Well, you can develop that on something like the breath or a mantra or visualization. And it can develop into a very powerful, like laser-like mind. It feels very pure and very pristine. A lot of ecstasy and rapture can arise when the mind is that absorbed in one thing. And there are practices to do that. These concentration practices is something the Buddha learned from the yogic traditions of India of his time. So he just kind of studied those as a student, of a yogi student, and learned them and then incorporated some of them in his system. What the Buddha discovered that seemingly was different and new in his religious context was not the concentration practices, but rather the mindfulness practices, what we do here, what I'm teaching. And the mindfulness practice requires some concentration and some stability of mind, but it's a different kind of concentration, because rather than being absorbed and focused on one thing only and lost in that one thing, it's being concentrated and focused in the present moment, but being present for the present moment as a present moment experience changes and flows. So one point is fixed concentration, just fixing yourself on one thing and just kind of locking on there and not aware of anything else. The fluid concentration of mindfulness is really present in the present. The mind doesn't waver from the present, but the present moment, you're open to whatever occurs in the present moment, the stream and flow of experiences, and our full humanity of experiences. The tendency for concentration practice is that it isolates or shuts off different parts of our experience. And it's very addictive, pure concentration practice, because you can get extremely, extremely calm and peaceful and get very blissed out sometimes. And then you get on Highway 101 at 5 o'clock, and you know, you get furious and upset, and you've lost it all. And then there's a tendency, people do a lot of concentration practice, to then criticize Highway 101. or whatever it is. Criticize the world. The world is the problem. The world is kind of causing me to lose my pure state of mind. And then they have this create a world-rejecting philosophy. you know, reject, or it's the emotions is the problem, their world is the problem, whatever. That's a tendency. Though it can be quite useful to do concentration practices. And the mindfulness practice is more about learning to be really present for what's actually happening in the present, so that when you leave here and go on the freeway at 5 o'clock, and there's rush hour, you have enough, you're not holding on to some peace or some calm, but you have the skills to see how the mind begins to react. You're just fine getting onto the on-ramp, and then you're ready to get onto the freeway, and this guy doesn't let you in. And you notice that, and then you notice that irritation comes up. And then you know, oh, it's interesting, irritation is there, that's interesting. And because you've learned to be mindful, you can just let the irritation be there, maybe, and not do anything with it. Or if you're not mindful of the irritation, then the irritation might lead to kind of compulsive action, where you do something with your finger. and you hardly, you know, you kind of know you're doing it, but it's kind of compulsive action. Or the irritation kind of escalates into, you know, self-criticism. How can I have been so dumb to get on the freeway at 5 o'clock in the afternoon? And then you say, oh, you know, why do I always make these poor choices in my life? I'm always making poor choices, and I'm such a klutz. And I've been doing this meditation practice where I'm supposed to be peaceful, and I'm not peaceful. I've blown it. I'm a spiritual failure. And so the mind escalates and spins out in all these stories. But if mindfulness can really see what's happening moment by moment and stay there for the changing reactions and experiences of what's going on, it can notice things earlier, and there's some choice then not to get caught up and lost in them and act compulsively. So for that reason, Buddhism says that it's mindfulness practice that brings wisdom, brings understanding. And concentration practice in and of itself is very healing and purifying, but doesn't bring wisdom and understanding. And ultimately, from a Buddhist point of view, the enlightenment that Buddhism talks about, that this practice is said only to come from this particular practice of mindfulness, not from concentration practices. So most of you are not going to be interested in enlightenment, but it's very nice that, maybe it's nice for you to know that you're doing a practice that does lead there. So, you know, sometimes it happens by accident. By accident. May you be accident prone. So this kind of practice does require some concentration, some stability of mind. And if your mind is just completely out, then count your breath for sure. Or I think the first night I think I suggested one thing we do, which is a little bit closer to mindfulness, is we name the breath. So that when you breathe in, you might say very, very, very soft whisper in the back of the mind, in, or rising, for the rising of the chest or the abdomen. When the breath goes out, you say out, or falling, for the falling. And very, very soft and subtle. And that does a number of things. It's using a thought to stay present rather than letting your thoughts be free to do whatever they want. And it's using also, it's also encouraging you, the mind, to stay present, kind of pointing the mind in the direction that you want it to be. So rather than counting, you might try the naming, and maybe that, but if that doesn't work, then by all means count. Yeah?
How does this mesh with the practices of Gurdjieff?
Sorry, how does it mesh with?
The practices of Gurdjieff?
I don't know enough about that to be qualified to answer. Though I have seen people say that Gurdjieffian practice is also a mindfulness practice, and very compatible and similar to what we do. The one kind of Gurdjieffian exercise that I've seen involves a kind of split attention, where the person is mindfulness is both in the activities they're doing and in what's happening in the body at the same time, and kind of splitting the attention in two. And we kind of do that, but our focus tends to be more, at least explicitly, on bringing your full attention to what you're really doing predominantly in the moment, rather than splitting it. And so that tends to be the case. But the mind is actually very fast, and what actually happens is the mind actually can go back and forth. And becoming aware of what the body's reactions is in any given situation is extremely important. So I hope that Birgit talked a little bit about that last week, mindfulness of the body and daily life.
What's the proper name for the method of meditation that you're teaching?
Mindfulness is fine name. The Buddhist word is, there's two words. Sati is literal translation for mindfulness. And the word sati doesn't have the word mind in it. It's kind of, you know, Western thing, right? We like the mind, so we've chosen this word mindfulness to translate sati. And it could just as well be called bodyfulness or heartfulness, you know, whatever, but it's the ability to pay attention, to be aware. The other word which is used when the mindfulness gets developed more strongly with a fair amount of concentration is vipassana. And vipassana means to see, and vi is kind of like an emphatic prefix. So some people translate it as clear seeing. And so what mindfulness is cultivating is the ability to see clearly into the present moment, and very deeply, to have a great penetration as the practice gets deeper.
Does this come out of Buddhism or Tibetan Buddhism versus Zen?
It comes out of Indian Buddhism. This is the practice that the historical Buddha taught. So it has a great antiquity in Buddhism. And then Tibetan Buddhism was formulated over 1,000 years after the Buddha was lived. And Zen also about 1,000 years afterwards. So Buddhism had gone through a lot of changes. But this particular tradition that I'm teaching from traces itself back to that early teachings. And if you read the early discourses of the Buddha, you'll find instructions that I'm teaching. They didn't have Highway 101 then. So maybe that's enough talking. Maybe we should start with a little sitting. So make yourselves comfortable in a stable, meditative posture. And then just directly close your eyes and take a moment to discern, to notice, what is the basic mood or mental state, emotional state that is present for you? It might be quite subtle or could be quite strong, but there's always a flavor of a mood, being calm or agitated, irritated, or content, or happy, restless, sad, confused. And you might just name it to yourself silently and allow that mood or state just be there, like it's free to be there as it wishes. Notice what happens to it as you acknowledge it. Sometimes we don't necessarily know what our emotional state is or mood until we stop and pay attention to it. But by noticing it, we might notice the filter through which we perceive or interpret or experience what's going on. The filter through which we're going to experience our meditation. So take a couple of deep breaths. Connect to your body from the inside. Relaxing as you breathe out. And then let your breath breathe itself normally, whatever way it wants. And take a few moments to feel your body. How's your body right now? Your experience of being embodied. And whatever experience of being embodied you have is fine. Just notice what's here. And then within your embodied sense of self, your embodied experience, become aware of your breathing. Each inhalation and each exhalation is quite unique, like each snowflake is different. This particular in-breath will never occur again. This particular out-breath will never be again. Allow yourself to experience each inhalation and each exhalation without straining. Whenever you notice the mind wanders off in thought and loses the connection with the breathing, resume the mindful breathing, simply allowing the breath to breathe itself, and as the body breathes, to let that be in awareness. There's no need to be concerned about whether you're doing it right or wrong. Just whenever you notice, whenever you remember, come back to your breathing, letting yourself rest with the inhalations and exhalations. Doing a mindfulness practice requires some effort. And a lot of the art of meditation is finding just the right amount of effort, appropriate amount of effort. The Buddha likened it to tuning the lute, the string of a lute. If you tighten the string too much, make too much effort, then the lute clangs, makes an ugly sound. And if you if the string is too loose, then it also kind of makes an ugly sound. But just the right amount of tautness in the string, you get a beautiful sound. If you make too much effort, you'll get tense in the meditation. But if you don't make enough effort, then the mind will wander off into thought much of the time. So can you find that balance of effort that helps you to be more present than not? Your mind will still wander off and get lost at times. But there's a kind of brightness, a kind of alertness in the effort to be present with the breath, to be present resting with the breath. And then as you're sitting here, take a few moments to let go of the breath and scan through your body to see if you can find the strongest physical sensation in your body. What is the strongest physical sensation you feel right now? And whatever that is, bring your mindfulness, bring your attention to that sensation. Allowing it to be there. Not trying to get rid of it or change it. But simply to hold that strong sensation in the field of awareness. Allowing the awareness to explore that sensation, getting to know it better. Noticing what, if anything, happens to the sensation as you're aware of it. And you might, very softly and gently, name the physical experience in a very simple, kind of obvious label. As a way of helping you stay present. And then letting go of that, return softly again to your breathing. sustaining an attention, sustaining your attention on the in-breaths and out-breaths. And then let go of your breath again, paying attention to it. And now spend a few moments noticing now what is your mood or emotional state, your mental state. What is the predominant, strongest emotional mood that's present? And if you can discern what it is, very, very softly, name it to yourself. Matter-of-factly. And as you feel it, allowing it to be there, is there some physical, energetic place in the body that seems to express this emotional state the most? Is there some place in your body that, what physical experience in your body informs you that this is your mood? Some feeling in the face or in the skull or in the neck or shoulders or the chest, stomach, hands, back. And if you can find the physical place in the body, the sensations in the body that correlate with this mood or emotion, then let your attention settle itself on that physical place, that's those sensations, allowing both the sensations and the mood to be there as it wishes. Noticing what happens. And then I'll ring the bell 3 times to end the sitting. And as you listen to the ring, spend some time doing mindfulness of sounds. As you listen to each of the 3 rings before you open your eyes. So as I said earlier, mindfulness has a lot to do with bringing as stable as you can, bringing awareness to what's happening in the present moment, and noticing the changing flow of what happens in the present. To stay in the present, then allow the present to unfold whatever way it wants. It's kind of like opening the blinds in the window really wide at your house, and then looking out and just noticing what happens in the streets. Things pass by and change and whatever. Mindfulness is kind of like that. You open the blinds of your mind and keep them open, and then you simply notice what happens within that. To give us a little bit better sense of how to do that, the teaching is to pay attention to whatever is predominant in the present moment. In any given moment, there's usually one thing which is predominant, the strongest experience. And rather than kind of paying attention to everything all at once, or not knowing what to pay attention to, the mindfulness practice is to pay attention to what is the main thing that you're experiencing, the predominant experience. When I was introduced to this practice in Thailand, I was given the instructions very quickly, in about half an hour, rather than a 5-week course like you're getting. And the way I interpreted it was, pay attention to everything. So I went, and it was a very noisy monastery, and so I sat down in my little cabin and proceeded to try to pay attention to everything. And I realized that there was so much going on, I couldn't quite do that, so that I'll just pay attention to all the sounds. But it was a noisy monastery, and I was chasing after all the sounds, all, you know, trying to get all of them. And I only ended up with a headache. So then I went back to my teacher and said, you know, I've got a headache. And he said, oh, you misunderstood. You're not trying to pay attention to everything at the same time. You're kind of in a calm way paying attention to whatever is predominant in the present moment. So when we first sit down to meditate, we kind of basically put our attention on the breath. The breath is kind of default practice. Its breath is always happening. So we're cultivating and strengthening our ability to be present by staying with the breathing, which is kind of constantly in motion, usually. And then something else will happen that becomes more predominant than the breath itself. It could be a sound, it could be a physical sensation, it could be an emotion. At that point, the instructions is to let go of the breath and let your attention, your mindfulness, your awareness, settle itself, become focused on that new thing that's predominant. I mean, another way of saying this is to distinguish between the foreground and background of awareness. We place the breath in the foreground of our awareness. And there could be many things that are in the background. Sounds, sensations, thoughts, feelings, or whatever. As long as they're in the background, you don't need to do anything about them. As long as you can keep the breath in the foreground and stay focused and sustain your attention with the breathing. The mind wanders off, just resume the mindful breathing. At some point or other, something will come from the background and come into the foreground. Now, if something has come into the foreground, has become the predominant object, that kind of means it wants your attention. And if you're trying to stay with a breath, when something else wants your attention, you set up a kind of tension between the two. And that's a recipe for frustration. And what we do in this practice is that we let go of the breath and we bring our attention to what's the new thing that's in the foreground, the predominant thing. And we bring our attention to it and just be there with it, allowing it to be there, feeling it as it is, experiencing it as closely and intimately as we can, and noticing what happens as we're aware of it. Once it's no longer in the foreground, or once it kind of feels well acknowledged, then you might go back to the breathing, or to something else that's come into the foreground. Maybe you're with an itch for a while, you're with a breath, and then the itch came up, so you went to the itch, and you hung out with the itch for a few minutes. And then the itch seemed to reside a little bit, and then this dog barking in the neighborhood was really loud. And that came really in the foreground, this loud barking. So then then you let go of the itch and you stay with the barking for listening, just doing listening meditation with the barking. Until that's either no longer got your attention, no longer kind of predominant, or it stopped. And then maybe at that point you go back to your breathing. What this means is that in this kind of meditation practice, there are no such things as distractions. There's nothing which we consider to be outside of the meditation practice. Anything that we can experience can become the meditation if it becomes the predominant experience. And we just bring our attention to it. And so we can. It's very helpful to name the experience. So listening, 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 or itching, 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 whatever. Very softly and gently, as I said earlier, as a way of kind of both keeping you on track and kind of pointing the mind to what's predominant and staying there. So today what I wanted to talk about was emotions. Last week, Brigitte talked about body sensations and how to include them as part of the practice. Emotions are just as much part of our human experience as anything else. And as we're cultivating awareness of whatever happening in the present moment, it's very important for us to include emotions, because that's part of what human experience includes also. And we do it in Buddhist practice in a kind of a matter-of-fact way, in the sense that we're not overly interested in emotions, and we're not underly interested in emotions. It isn't. Some people in our culture are afraid of their emotions or repressed from their emotions, and so stay away from them and don't think they're okay to be with. And some people have these great manifestos about what emotions mean, and everybody has to have their emotions, my emotions are important, and all this stuff. And, you know, emotions are like a main thing going for human beings, and everybody needs to know it, or, you know, whatever, right? I'm sorry to go on. And in Buddhism, there's kind of a matter-of-fact approach. We're just simply paying attention to what happens to be predominant. No stories about making. We don't try to make stories about it or justify it or criticize it or explain it away or whatever. If it's happening and it's predominant, we pay attention to it. That's all. Isn't that nice and simple? So when emotions are, but emotions are an important part of our life, and so we include them as part of the practice. We don't exclude them. And part of our learning to be with emotions is to neither, in any kind of way, repress them or discount them, or to fuel them or act on them or express them in some active kind of way. There are two poles. You know, for a while in our culture, the stoic, silent man was the kind of ideal. Some of you might remember, you know, maybe still some circles. And, you know, and so we were kind of repressed in a certain period of time. And then came, you know, the 60s and 70s, and people reacted against the repressed emotionality of the time. And then it became catharsis was the name of the game. And so there was a lot of therapy about catharsis of expressing. And then it turned out that by some point, by the 80s or whatever, a lot of therapists started realizing that catharsis was overvalued, overemphasized. So it has its place, but it was overemphasized. And what happened is some people who were constantly catharting their anger were becoming more angry people, kind of reinforcing certain habits. In Buddhist practice, we're trying to kind of find the middle way between repression and expression, which means allowing the emotion to be there in its full glory, allowing it to be there just as it is, but not acting on it or trying to make something happen out of it. So if in a conversation with someone, for example, someone does something that causes you to get angry, the mindful statement would be to tell your friend, you're not acting, repressing it, and you're not acting on it. And another way another kind of response would be, you no good lousy bum. You're expressing your anger, right? You're letting them know you're angry and you're kind of expressing it, but you're getting involved. You're acting it out. Another response would be kind of, oh, there's no problem here, you know. I feel fine. So that the middle way is a truthful way, just simply stating it as it is without getting involved. So same thing with the meditation practice, just need to be with it and not either to act on it or fuel it or to or deny it or repress it. So in this last sitting, I asked you to, at the beginning and near the end, to notice what emotions or mental state or mood seem to be present for you, at the, and then to spend some time allowing it to be there and see what happened as you were present for it. And at the end, to ask you to also to feel it physically in your body. What was it like for some of you to do that? Was that interesting or difficult, or did you discover something interesting in the process? You guys got to help. This is a mindfulness class. You have to have a little bit of mindfulness of what's going on so you can speak also. You know, so please, something. Yes?
I've had a pain, and when you said to pay attention to it, it was interesting because the pain didn't seem to lessen in any way, but it became different, kind of porous or something. So that it wasn't as bothersome.
Beautiful. That often happens. When we hold ourselves at a distance from our experience, what we often relate to is not the experience itself purely, but rather our concept of it. And our concepts of it is often much more ominous and fixed and whatever than what it is actually to experience. So to drop below the concepts and bring ourselves closer to experience it, porous is a great word. Thank you. Yes.
I found that I can name emotions and not really know what it means. Or, I mean, the names just sort of wander in. So in the beginning, I was, the feeling was just sort of set somehow. I didn't know what it means.
Was what?
Set.
Set.
Yeah, you asked what my
emotional state was. And
yeah, it was set, sort of in a ready kind of way.
Uh-huh.
And in the end, it turned into settled, which is a slightly different emotion.
Yeah. I think it was fine. So what's the issue? You had a reservation.
Not just the naming emotion that way.
Oh.
But the names came anyway.
That seems fine. And it was something you're actually feeling, and that was the kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an unnecessary part of mindfulness, but it's a very useful part is to name an experience for the reasons I said earlier. It's not that important that the name is accurate, even. Its function is mostly to keep you on track to set. What we're mostly trying to do is be with the felt sense of the experience, not getting caught up in the right or wrongness of the label. But emotions are interesting because, given what I just said, the more accurate we are with the descriptive name of the emotions, the more the mindfulness and the naming of it tends to free us of the emotion. It's kind of like the way that in old fairy tales, people name the dragon and the dragon lost its power. The power that of the emotions that lessens as we name it is the power of our preoccupation with it, the power of our identification with it. And so when we can bring this kind of clear mindfulness that doesn't identify with it, just sees it for what it is, then that softens the preoccupation. And it loses some of its power, hold over us. So, for example, some years ago, I remember I was feeling lousy, kind of really lousy, and so I went and lay down. And so, because I often do mindfulness, I kind of laid there. And said, well, this is interesting. Let me pay attention here. What's going on, rather than just kind of complain in my head. And so I paid attention, and I could feel that my chest couldn't relax as I was breathing. It was kind of extended. And I couldn't quite settle as I exhaled. Just was just kind of taut. So I brought my attention to that and just felt that tension in my chest. And then at one moment, the word depression came through. And I named it, it's depression. And as soon as I named it, the chest relaxed. There's a kind of way in which our hold or its hold over us. So emotions, even though you don't have to have an accurate name, and you're not supposed to, in mindfulness, spend much time analyzing for just the right name. There's some specific significance with naming when it comes to emotions that can be very useful. To one or two other people, if you don't mind. Yes?
Yeah, I felt, I think it was a combination of resistance and fatigue. I just couldn't pay attention to my breath, and it didn't feel like or didn't seem like monkey mind. I didn't feel like my mind was jumping all over the place. I even tried opening my eyes part way to get a little light in to try to counteract the fatigue, but it didn't. For some reason, I just, you know, I couldn't stay with the breath for more than in. So I don't know if you would call it an emotion, but it seemed like some kind of resistance. But I just couldn't, through my conscious will, pay attention to my breath.
Great. So this is a very important point. So in that case, what it seems is that the resistance is the main issue that's going on, the predominant issue, the predominant experience. So what you want to do then is stop paying attention to the breath and bring your full attention to the resistance and the fatigue. And you can do half an hour of resistance meditation. Just feel the resistance in your body. Where do you experience the resistance in your body? Is it in the chest or in the stomach or in the hands? what does it actually feel like? What's the texture and quality and flavor of it? What's the size of it? Kind of go in there and kind of just explore it, investigate this, what it feels like, the resistance. And notice what emotions might be connected to it. Kind of explore it in a kind of free way. And as you do that, notice what happens to it. And nothing needs to happen, but you're cultivating your ability to be present with what's one of the primary things that's happening, and that's great. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the art of this kind of practice is the art of learning what is actually the predominant thing that's going on, because it isn't always so obvious, even though it sounds like it should be. And so sometimes you need to kind of step back for a minute and kind of just get a general global view to see, am I missing something here that's really obvious? Yes?
Well, I have quite a few experiences, and I don't know if I'm drifting off to sleep or not, but I have these little short stories of characters going on, as if it was a dream, perhaps, and it lasts for a short time, and then I kind of realize that I'm not breathing, and I come back to the breathing and kind of cut it off. But they're interesting stories. They're not dull or boring or feel like they're a waste of time. It feels like it's a really interesting thing to do, and feels like the last one felt like a shame to kind of cut it off. So I don't know this person's story she was telling me, which is crying at the end. I don't know what happened.
How
stay with that? Or
it might be the compassionate thing. next week we'll talk a little bit about thoughts and cognitive experiences like that, you know, and images even. But generally, if something like that becomes predominant, you want to then that becomes what you bring your mindfulness to. But you do it not to get involved in it, but simply to notice seeing is happening. And one of the things that fuels continuity of such things is interest. And so interest can be very seductive. So rather than being mindful and cultivating presence and awareness, you're really strengthening your interest and curiosity and getting in there. And I mean, it's a fine thing to do, to stay there and listen to her story. But in doing that, you're choosing to do something different than to cultivate and strengthen your mindfulness. And the suggestion I have is that when you're doing the meditation practice itself, try not to do anything else, like plan your schedule for the day, or solve problems, or have conversations with imaginary people. because it's not what we're trying to do, and reinforces kind of a bad habit then. And really what we're trying to do is, in this particular setting, is to cultivate and strengthen our ability to be present in the present moment without getting caught by something and lost in something. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And if you're interested in that agenda, then, you know, just wake up. And you can actually wake up to you can wake up in the present moment to the fact that you're having this kind of conversation or an image or whatever. But that kind of waking up is a different kind of presence than going into it and getting lost in it, right? It's kind of like you're stepping back and seeing it. Oh, I'm a human being here who's having this fantasy. And by stepping that far back and seeing it as that kind of way, then you're no longer enmeshed in it, and you're seeing it for what it is. Make sense? Okay. So emotions are a very important part of our lives, an important part of the practice. And I wanted to describe four aspects of mindfulness of emotions that I think kind of help clarify what we're doing here. You can take them as being different, or you can take them to be all kind of the same thing. But the first thing that's important with emotions is to recognize their presence. And that often is 90% of the work. It's not always so easy to recognize the presence of an emotion. And simply to recognize it brings some freedom and some space. As I often say here, when I was younger, I was a person who wasn't supposed to be angry. And so if you have that kind of person, self-image, guess what? You tend not to see your anger. And that's what happened with me. And I wouldn't see that I was angry or admit it until my anger became, problematic. Or so difficult. It wouldn't take external forms. I would all internalize it. It would kind of take the form of great frustration and whatever. And finally, it was so hopelessly impossible to do anything else that I had to admit it. And then once I admitted it, it kind of loosened up. But as long as I couldn't see it, it would kind of fester there and have its own life and be frozen. So the more important thing is to recognize it. And that's often a big, tall order to do. But to recognize the emotion. The second aspect is to allow it to be there. Sometimes I use the word to accept it. Acceptance is different than condoning it or justifying it. Acceptance is just simply allowing it to be there, not trying to argue it away or push it away or justify it or enhance it or do anything with it, but simply allow it to be there. And that's, also is often kind of difficult. I call this having uncomplicated emotions. What many of us do is we complicate our emotions by our reactions to them. So I might feel joy, and if I come from a certain religious tradition that has certain teachings about joy, I might feel this is close to sinful to feel joy and the physical experiences of pleasure and all that. And so I might feel ashamed of the fact that joy has arisen. And then once shame is there, I can say, it's unfortunate that shame is there, and it's kind of a bad thing to happen. It's kind of embarrassing. And then I might get angry with myself for being shameful of the fact that I feel some joy. And so there's all these ways in which we complicate. Grief is a good example. We have this wonderful expression in English called good grief. But no one knows what it means. But the concept is really great. The idea that there's appropriate way of grieving, there's good grief. And when you grieve, it's painful to grieve, but there's good grief to have. The opposite of good grief, whatever we want to call that, bad grief. I don't want to be careful how we judge things, but the opposite is we have grief and we complicate it with such things like maybe guilt for feeling grief. Some people feel grief over someone's death, and they grieve for 6 months, and then they meet a friend, and the friend says, "Get off it, you've grieved long enough." And that's a very disrespectful thing to say. But then they internalize and say, "Oh yeah, there must be something wrong with me because I'm not over my grief yet." And suddenly the grief has become complicated. Or anger, or despair, or all these ways in which we kind of add a layer of reactivity on top of it. The Buddha gave the story. He asked his students once, if a person is struck by an arrow, is that painful? That person experience pain. And the audience said, yes. They were more quicker to answer than you are. And then I'm trying to kind of loosen you up. So then the Buddha said, if that person was struck by a second arrow, is that even more painful? Twice as much pain. And the people said, yes, that's even more painful. And he said, sometimes in life, you can't control the first arrow, but you have some choice over the second. And what he meant is that the first arrow is what happens to you in your life. The second arrow is how you respond in relationship to that. If your knee hurts in meditation, like my friend whose knee hurt, so he decided to hurt his knee back. He was pushed into his knee. You know, he'd feel more pain. Or some of us, when we feel physical pain, we get angry with ourselves for having it, or we feel aversion towards it. And having that kind of a relationship of aversion, we tighten up more around the physical pain and it can get worse. An emotion arises, and who knows why it arose, but then we add a second arrow to it, if it's a painful one or whatever. Sometimes it's a pleasant emotion, we add the second arrow, or the so-called second arrow. There's many ways in which we add second arrows to our life. And what we're trying, one of the things we're trying to do in this kind of practice is not to stop any of our ability to feel emotions, and not to be selective and say some emotions are right and some emotions are wrong, to allow them all to be there, but then try to allow them to be there in an uncomplicated manner. Does that make sense? Which means try not to lay layers of judgment and aversion or clinging or attachment on top of it. Just allow it to be there in its full glory, that particular emotion. So the first thing is to recognize it, and the second is to allow it, to recognize it by itself, not to complicate it, if you can. Most of us, including myself, will complicate. We'll add a second arrow. When you've added the second arrow, that's what's happened. If you judge yourself negatively for adding the second arrow, you know what you've done?
Third.
Hey, you're catching on. You're
warming up.
Warming up, yeah. So, and some of us, you know, we have 52 arrows. You know, reaction, reaction, reaction. And that's okay. From a Buddhist point of view, it's okay you added 52 arrows. If that's what's happened, don't add the 53rd. So Buddhism is very compassionate and allowing. This practice just allows you to be who you are. When you wake up, you're allowed to be just who you are when you woke up. And then you wake up. You allow it to be there like that. Easier said than done, I know. What we're trying to do is to allow our emotions to be there. Allow anything to be there. The word emotions, maybe many of you know, the E of emotion means, it's kind of Latin, and it means to go out, outward. And motion means motion. To move out, to be in motion. That's what emotions are. And emotions are always in motion, unless they're frozen. And guess who freezes them?
The person who catches all the arrows.
Very good. The person who catches, and also, but get, you know something? The person who catches the arrow, the second arrow, is also the person who sent it. So by allowing emotion to be there, it's beginning to soften the doing that we have in relationship to it, which is sometimes the freezing of it, if it's certain emotions. Even joy and great happy emotions can somehow get frozen and we have attachment, and we kind of interrupt the natural flow of them. Because of the natural flow and movement of emotions, most emotions will have their own process to process themselves. And if we just get out of the way and allow ourselves to experience it fully in the present moment, it'll take care of itself. Even though it can be very frightening and very challenging, and can actually get more difficult before it gets kind of more pleasant, if we get out of the way and let the natural process unfold, it's almost as if we don't have to do it. We don't have to figure it out or analyze it or understand the history of it. All we have to do is really fully allow it to be there in its glory without any kind of entanglement with it. It's a very happy news, isn't it? I think it's great. So, recognize it, allow it to be there. The third thing is to name it. And I talked about that a little bit already. And the naming, the mental noting, we call it, the noting of the experience, is something that some mindfulness students will do kind of in a slow, steady, ongoing rhythm. Hearing, hearing, itching, itching, rising, falling, rising, hearing, pain, pain, tightening, thinking, thinking, just kind of slowly and steadily. So you don't have to do that. It's not necessarily part of the practice, but it's extremely helpful to do that for some people. And I would encourage you to try that. It helps you stay on track. And you'll find how easy it is not to be on track, how easy it is to get lost. And this is a great aid to do that. And with emotions in particular, as I said, it's like naming the dragon in the fairy tales. It kind of frees us a little bit from them. If we can name them in kind of a matter-of-fact way without making a story out of it. And the fourth thing with emotions is to investigate it, to get to know it better. What we're not interested in mindfulness practice particularly is the story connected to the emotion. And many of us, that's where our focus of attention goes when an emotion arises, a story, what it means, who did it, how I'm going to respond, and all that. In a sense, often enough, the storyline adds to the frozenness of the emotional response. It kind of interrupts the natural flow of its own processing. There's certainly a time and a place to get involved with the story. But in mindfulness practice itself, we usually don't get involved. But rather, we really give preference to the felt sense of the experience. And emotions will almost always be experienced physically in the body. And is, you know, we say to be in touch with our emotions. It's no accident we say that. You know, heat, anger is heat in the face, or tightness in the chest, fear is a tightness in the stomach, and joy is a kind of wonderful tingling delight that kind of up in the head, perhaps, or happiness is this warm, soothing kind of feeling kind of passing through the chest. Emotions are, we kind of know we have emotions because of what happens in the body to inform us that's the case. So what we do in mindfulness when we investigate, we tend to kind of bring our attention to the physical component side of the emotion, just like we would a physical sensation itself, and kind of rest there and be with there and allow it to be there. Explore it, get to know it. Notice what our relationship is. Notice how we add a second arrow, or how we get attached, or how we judge it, all that. Just to notice. As soon as we notice, we're a little bit freer from it. You don't have to notice it and criticize it, just to notice. The practice is always just to notice, just to notice. The practice is not to notice and then judge yourself for it, or to notice and then, you know, want it to be different. The practice is to notice. This is what's happening. This is what's happening. I'm judging. Oh, okay. Gail told me I wasn't supposed to. Noticing. This practice is phenomenally compassionate and forgiving. Isn't it great? I think it's great. You can be the way you are. Isn't that great? I think it is. So we investigate, get into it. Investigate how it is physically. And the advantage of that is that our physical experience is always in the present moment. When we're in the story, we can soon enough get lost in the present. We're in what happened yesterday. We're in the past, yesterday or tomorrow or whatever. So it helps us ground us in the present. It anchors us in the present to be in the physical experience of the emotion. And it helps curb the tendency to get lost in the story. So it's very powerful. And you can stay present for an emotion. And what tends to happen as we stay present for an emotion, if we're not frozen with the emotion, if we're really present for it in a calm and relaxed way, is that the movement of the emotions begins to set in. And you can actually follow the changes. And sometimes it changes in all kinds of... we don't know which direction it's going to change. It might become more difficult, or might come more easy or more pleasant. Your job is not to be concerned which direction it goes. Your job is to get out of the way and let it take whatever direction it wants to take. And sometimes difficult emotions can feel a lot more difficult. And now you've heard it from me. That's one of the things that can happen. It's okay. You might feel a lot of fear. And then part of the practice then is to learn to ride the edge of fear and get familiar with fear. If it gets too overwhelming an emotion, then you might want to back off and not go so far into it, and maybe go back to your breathing in a very matter-of-fact way and not kind of go into it so fully if it really seems to be too troublesome. But if it's not too troublesome, kind of follow the edge of strong emotions and kind of be with it and see what happens. And with time, one of the most useful things we learn in this practice is our confidence in ourselves, or trust in ourselves, or trust in the practice, or trust in life, whatever you want to call it, to experience whatever happens to us, to experience our full full spectrum of our inner life and the outer life, to have enough confidence that we can bring presence and mindfulness to a situation instead of reactivity. And that's a wonderful thing to trust, to have that kind of trust, that it's okay to do that. And it takes a while to learn that because we have so many conditioned reactions and responses to both the inner life and the outer life. One definition of enlightenment is when the trust has become all-pervasive. So this might sound complicated, you know, for all these different steps of mindfulness of emotions and all this. Mindfulness practice is not supposed to be analytical and trying to figure out and remembering all this. It's supposed to actually be very, very simple. It's more like as I said, it's like pulling the blinds in your window. And you don't have to strain and figure out, you know, how to look. And you just, the person walks by and you see it. Someone else walks by, you see that person. The bird flies by, you see that. You just notice what's there when the window is open. And what I'm doing is kind of painting the picture of what you might notice. So if you start getting too complicated trying to figure out what you're supposed to do, relax. And let the present moment inform you what you're supposed to notice. So let the predominant experience inform you. And if an emotion is the predominant experience, let it come to you. Recognize it, notice it, allow it to be there, name it. And if it persists, investigate it, get to know it better. Does that make sense? Any questions about this? Yes.
How does free will sort of come into play here? I mean, it almost sounds like you could never go anywhere or do anything. You know, and I mean, it comes up in daily life all the time. You know, how much control do you have over the present? You know, you can go be someplace else, so you pay attention to where you are, and that's
right.
Sort of enough for
right.
itself in the practice. You know,
Right. It's a good question.
How do you sort of balance your control over the situation with sort of letting things happen?
Well, part of free choice is the choice of bringing mindfulness to the situation. So mindfulness is not a passive thing to do. It's actually an active thing to do. Even though once that active thing is there, you're kind of, in a sense, kind of passive in allowing whatever is there. In the formal meditation practice, the answer is for the most part, very easy. You don't have to make any choices, except to find what's the predominant thing and bring your attention there. But you don't have to necessarily change anything. What you're training yourself to do in meditation is to learn how to rest in a non-reactive place. That doesn't have to make anything different. To really get a taste of what that way of being is, to really be familiar with that, gives us a big toehold in learning how to be non-reactive in daily life. Non-reactive means acting habitually or compulsively. When we don't have to act on when something has happened, then there's a possibility of studying the situation, getting to know ourselves and the situation better, that we can respond wisely from wisdom. And what that is, what wisdom is, and how you're going to decide what to do, that's for you to find out. That's a whole subject in itself, wise choices, wise decisions. We can go on for quite a length to talk about that. But a lot of what the power of this, part of the power of this practice is slowly with time learning this place of non-reactivity and learning its value in helping us make decisions and respond rather than react. One of the things that we pay attention to in mindfulness, and in Buddhism it's kind of connected to the issue of emotions, and kind of included in that categories, is our intention. So when we have to make a decision, in mindfulness practice, we bring our attention to the intention, the motivation behind that decision. And we study the flavor of that motivation. Two people can have the same motivation. One person just, for example, two people have to go to the drugstore to get medication. And maybe they have to get exactly the same kind of, I don't know what. I can't think of something good here, but let's say they have a headache. Both people have headaches. seems like a very reasonable thing to go to the drugstore and get an aspirin. You know, and I do it sometimes. It's not like, you know, it's a reasonable thing. But one person just realizes that there's a headache and realizes it's a problem, and she has to kind of give this big important talk, and if it can continue, it's okay for her to have the headache, but if it just persists, she can't really think that clearly, and she can't give this important talk very well, so she's going to have an aspirin. That seems kind of, you know, that's the motivation. Someone else goes into the drugstore, has that headache, and they both make the same decision to buy an aspirin. The second one decision is maybe the same thing. I have to go give this talk, but I need to kind of really impress them with how smart I am and how elegant I am and how vivacious I am and how better than them that I am. And if I show up with a headache, I can't show my great natural kind of superiority to them. So I'm going to get this aspirin so I can prove to them how superior I am. My train of thought is not so good, but I'm just kind of making something up. You could make in your mind a better analogy. And so the second one, that decision is based part on greed and ambition and self-image and self-protection and all that. So the motivation is quite different than the first one. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
So one of the things, when we don't react compulsively, but are comfortable letting things be as they are for at least a moment, then we can study what our choices are and the motivation behind them. And the motivations have different spins. And in Buddhism, at least, they say you should be very careful of those spins that are tied to greed, hate, or delusion. Be very careful. And those spins that have, those motivations that have the spin of generosity and love and wisdom, maybe that's the ones you should choose.
Well, that helps to distinguish or to pay attention to the intention.
Right. So let's end with a short sitting. Those of you been sitting on the floor, if you want to stand for 10 seconds, you can. And also Shaila's class. So again, if you'd like, you can close your eyes. And again, just simply notice what your mood or mental state or your energetic state is right now. Being mindful of what's happening is kind of like making space for it, making room for it, for that experience. So being mindful of your emotional state right now. What happens if you make room for it? And then you might take a couple of deep breaths to help you really be here, to remind you to be here. And then opening the curtains to your awareness, opening your window. And in that window, let the breath, the experience of breathing, simply arrive there by itself. And attempt the best you can to sustain that attention to the breathing. Not straining, but not being too complacent or lax either. So perhaps I talked too much this evening and didn't give you enough chance to sit during an hour and a half. But since we're a tradition of allowing things to be, you'll be forgiving of me. I have a few announcements. Oh, one thing I want to add is during this next week, before our next class, in addition to continuing with the daily meditation practice, you might spend some time during your daily life noticing your emotions, noticing, especially when they're strong, just to get to know them, just that. But in particular, notice the difference between simply bringing more awareness to your emotions as opposed to some of the other options you have in relationship to emotions. Notice what that's like, what that does to you and does to the situation. Just to bring more, salt the situation with awareness before doing anything else. So a few announcements. One is that next week, we talked about concentration practice earlier today. And there's one concentration practice in particular that our tradition teaches that kind of complements mindfulness practice. And that is a practice called loving-kindness meditation. And it has other functions besides developing concentration. It develops a lot of kindness and friendliness. And it's a beautiful practice. And we're going to have a kind of an introductory course in loving-kindness meditation starting next Thursday from 5:30 to 6:30. And there's a... Very senior Vipassana student named Shaila, who's going to teach it. And Shaila is a wonderful person and wonderful teacher. And she's done a lot more loving kindness meditation in a formal way, done long retreats, long meditation retreats, where that's the only thing she was doing, much more than I have. So, in a sense, she's more qualified to teach it than I am. And I think it's a wonderful thing. And it's here from 5:30 to 6:30. So, it might be a little bit confusing for those of you who are trying, you know, just new to the mindfulness meditation to start being introduced to another one, but...
Did you say, is that next Thursday?
Starting next Thursday, 5:30, 6:30, so before this class. So some of you, you have that option. It's a kind of a nice thing to do. And I call it Vipassana happy hour. So otherwise, we'll meet here again. Next week, we'll talk about thoughts. How to include thoughts as part of the practice, and, if it seems relevant to some of you. The other thing is to remind you that the way that the system here of teaching these classes is to offer it on a donation basis. There are two baskets out there in the hallway for donations. One is labeled rent, and we pay the Friends, the Quakers, a rent for use of this building. And if everybody donated a dollar each time they came for the rent basket, that would be suffice for what we have to pay for rent. And the other basket is for a donation towards me. And that's freely for you to decide whatever you want to do. It's kind of very much a free way of doing it. But it's kind of, for some reason, I feel inspired or something to say today. If you want to consider a donation, you might also consider a little bit what you would pay for a comparable thing like this in kind of a normal life out there. Isn't this normal too, I suppose? Yeah. So anyway, you might do a little reflection on what other classes you go to, what you do there. But it's really up to you. You can do freely or do nothing at all if you wish. So, and the last thing is someone last week left a meditation bench. So someone remembers having forgotten it and is here. Maybe talk to Allison here. So thank you all. Good night.